Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at pem.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Governor Charlie Baker this afternoon announced the state is rolling back slightly its reopening to phase three, step one. That includes restrictions like closing food courts, requiring masks all the time at workplaces, and closing indoor performance venues. Here's the governor.
With our hospital system straining to keep up with the sharp increase in severely ill patients, we have to do more. And effective this Sunday, the Commonwealth will move every community in Massachusetts back to phase three, step one. This will reduce indoor capacities across a broad range of sectors of the economy and tighten several other workplace restrictions.
Now, this comes as we head deeper into the surge and with a vaccine rollout coming maybe as early as the weekend. We have a panel of medical experts here with us today, so let's talk. What are your reactions to these latest measures? Are you ready for a vaccine and will you take it? What else needs to happen for you to feel safe? And what do you need to know about the coronavirus now today? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a terrific panel for you. Joining us is Dr. Mark Seidner, a clinical epidemiologist at Massachusetts General Hospital and an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Also with us is Lenny Marcus, who is the founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, which is a joint program of the Harvard Chan School of Public Health and the Kennedy School of Government. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to have you both. And again, let me just put that number out one more time for our listeners, 1-800-423-8255. There is a lot of pandemic news to cover. It really does feel like we're moving, you know, day by day into new territory, or in some ways, it almost feels like old spring territory. Dr. Seidner, what are your reactions to the level of measure that Governor Baker decided to put in place today?
Yeah, I think you're going to be pretty hard-pressed to find public health experts who will be disappointed with the direction of this decision. On the other hand, you might find at least a handful who think this might not have gone far enough. You know, our research group and many others actually demonstrated pretty clearly that statewide measures like these really do help reduce cases, reduce hospitalizations and deaths. But I don't envy the governor's position. I mean, there's tens of thousands of people in the state in the service industry. And at this point of the epidemic and in the year, there really isn't much federal support for workers or for businesses if they close. Unemployment funding is drying up and we know food security is high. So I think this decision really shouldn't be taken too lightly. I think on one side, I'd say hospitalizations are, you know, 1,500 or so statewide. That's a 50% increase in the last 2 weeks. And for those who say it's still 50% less than it was at its peak, which is true, I think we should remember that we went from 1,500 cases to 4,000 cases in less than 2 weeks back in April. And it also takes time for people to become infected to develop a need for hospitalization. So I really think the question remains here. Were these measures enough? And if not, when and why would the governor pull the trigger on gun grid restrictions?
So, Lenny, let me actually invite you, Lenny Marcus, to answer Dr. Seidner's questions just there.
Well, in some ways, this is a situation of deja vu all over again. We had these sorts of numbers back in April, early in the pandemic. We learned a great deal from the close downs that happened at the time. People, to a large extent, cooperated. Here in Massachusetts, we did see a large percentage of the population wearing masks. That's critically important. And a tone was set early on that had a significant impact. In fact, Massachusetts was one of the leaders in the country on being proactive about these closings and being proactive about population collaboration and cooperation with these measures. And in many ways, we've got to go back and do it again. We're going into the winter months. We're after what looks like a bump from Thanksgiving. So this is a step in the right direction. The question is whether people in Massachusetts are willing to cooperate, whether they're willing to wear masks. We saw back right after the Boston Marathon bombings that people here in Massachusetts really can get on board in the midst of a crisis. And in many ways, what we need today is that same degree of getting on board, facing the crisis, and then together doing everything we can to reduce the spread of the disease and the hospitalizations.
You know, we are hearing so much in the media, in social media, and conversations back and forth about the tension between what cities and towns and state officials ought to do to curb behavior, provide restrictions, and this set of personal responsibilities that we have as a member of a community to each other to keep each other safe. Dr. Seigner, from a public health perspective, does history come down on one side of that tension or the other?
Well, I think what we've learned is that it's really difficult to paint this as a black and white issue. I think there are bad actors out there, and I think that public responsibility is critical, and that public messaging is critical, and that there are people out there that aren't playing by the rules and having indoor events and probably almost definitely increasing risk, not for themselves only, but for the rest of the community. On the flip side of that, you know, these restrictions have been in place, and there's a whole host of people that really don't have a choice. You know, restaurant workers need to come to work, and restaurant eating is by nature people spending long periods of time indoors in the winter with masks off. And asking people to make decisions between coming to work and providing for their families and potentially not getting infected when they don't have unemployment insurance and their businesses aren't being supported, I think is an impossible decision asking people to make. And I would say that I do think the governor has tried his best to try to get people to use personal responsibility to reverse this epidemic. And what I think we've seen over the last few weeks is a massive spike in cases, now a pretty massive spike in hospitalizations. And I don't think personal responsibility over the last few weeks has been enough to get us to where we need to be. And so there has to be a line drawn somewhere. And I do think we're quickly approaching that, because if we get to a place where ICUs do fill up, our ability to take care of people, not just with COVID, but also with other conditions, strokes, heart attacks, car accidents, is going to decrease to dangerously low levels.
All right. Thanks for that. I think we're ready to go to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Josh on the line from Hamilton. Josh, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I'm just wondering, the technology that's behind this vaccine seems to be a little bit different from what I'm hearing on the news. How is it similar or different from, say, the flu vaccine or other vaccines we've had in the past?
Thanks for that call, Josh. Which of you would like to take that one on?
I'm happy to field that. The other person may also have comments. But so historically speaking, most vaccines have been inactivated vaccines. So what we do is we take the pathogen, whether it be a virus or a bacteria, and we remove the parts of that which cause disease, the parts of it that make people sick. We still introduce it to the human body. The human body makes a response to that, an immune response, usually by developing these things called antibodies, which will protect us if we get infected in the future. Both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines don't use that technology. They use something called mRNA, which is our body's own ability to take something and develop a protein. So both of these vaccines basically trick our bodies into producing the protein on the outer surface of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Our body again gets fooled into thinking it's being exposed to the virus, even though it hasn't been. It's just been exposed to proteins that we're now making, and develops that same immune response, so that when we do get exposed or infected in the future, our body can recognize it, it can quickly control the virus, and we don't experience disease. mRNA vaccines are a technology that have been in the works for 20 or 30 years, but there isn't a prior record of an mRNA vaccine being used in humans, just because it's relatively new and there hasn't been a situation like this. What I can say is we now have two extremely well done studies by both Pfizer and Moderna in tens of thousands of people, which really unequivocally at this point demonstrate that this vaccine seems to protect people against COVID-19 disease. I think these results have been well beyond our expectations and incredibly reassuring.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Marcus, excuse me, yes.
Yeah, it'll be really important for the scientific community to be transparent and open with the population so that people really do understand what this vaccine is about, their questions are answered. If there are problems regarding safety, that there'll be transparency with that as well, because it's going to be critically important that we get cooperation from the population to get vaccinated, to follow the protocols, and hopefully to get us on the other side of this pandemic together.
Yeah, let's stay on that for a second, because coming a little bit later in the program, we're going to talk with Michael Curry of the Statewide Association of Community Health Centers about a Mass Inc. poll that came out today that shows that most people will take the vaccine, but many of them would like to go second, not first, because there are concerns about safety and historic distrust among some populations, including populations of color in Massachusetts, with the healthcare system. You know, Lenny Marcus and Dr. Seidner, I'd like to hear both from both of you very concrete steps that leaders in our communities can take to increase confidence in the vaccine and the uptake on it as quickly as possible. Maybe Dr. Seidner, I'll turn to you first.
Thank you. So it's an critically important question. And actually, I'd say that in some ways, the science has done its job, but the science may be at this point the easy part. The goal now is to figure out ways to interface with the community through public health messaging, through trusted leaders, through trusted thought leaders, so that people can get their questions answered, so that people can come to terms and understand what should they expect from this vaccine in terms of local reactions, in terms of minor reactions, what are the risks associated with it? What are the benefits? And those messages can't necessarily come from vaccine makers. And because of how fraught I think public messaging has been, it may not be able to come from our government either. We need now a buy-in from our trusted leaders in society to take over this campaign. Because now that these vaccines are developed, as Dr. Marcus just mentioned, there's a huge difference between a vaccine and vaccination. And we need to get these, what I think, believe to be, based on the data that have been reported, these safe and efficacious vaccines to communities in need, including communities that for hundreds of years, frankly, in our country, have not been provided adequate healthcare service or access. We need to make sure that their thought leaders are involved in helping to engender trust, getting people's questions answered, and making sure that we convert what I think is a true scientific discovery, the likes of which we haven't seen in my lifetime, to actual public health benefit by making sure that the right people get access and ultimately get vaccinated.
Lenny Marcus, I do want to give you a chance to add on, but before we do, I'd like to pick up a call and give you a chance to respond to it as well. So 800-423-8255, we've got Elle on the line from Newton. Elle, go ahead.
Hi. I was just wanted to comment on the Mass governor, Governor Baker, and I don't understand why he's been so hesitant to take action. Why not close indoor dining and then give some support to those restaurants as opposed to keeping indoor dining open? I've walked by restaurants where there's 30 or 40 people eating inside, talking, you know, for hours. So what is driving his hesitance to actually do something to protect us?
Thank you for that, Ellen. I will clarify for listeners that as part of the governor's order today, restaurants will go from 10 people at a table to 6 people at a table and a maximum of 90 minutes inside dining. Okay, Lenny Marcus, back to you. Thank you.
Well, that's a really important question. It's a question that we're all facing. We would love to see our society open up. We would love to see people go back to work. We would love to be able to go to restaurants and to go to gatherings and be together. And there is that tension of getting the economy back and moving, along with the need to recognize that the community spread has been increasing enormously. The impact on people in our population, the impact on hospitals can't be ignored. So there's a tension. And what the governor and other political leaders are seeking to do is to drive a balance in that tension such that people, as Dr. Seidner earlier said, can go to work, but not put others at danger. You know, the other thing I think, just to go back to the question of vaccinations, we study leaders in times of crisis. And we define leadership in times of crisis as people follow you. So it's not simply a matter of establishing the science, as Dr. Seidner said, which has been established, but it's going to be important to see political leaders publicly taking the vaccine. Former presidents, President Obama and Bush, for example, have committed to taking the vaccine in public. Faith-based leaders, community leaders, business leaders, the way we're going to convince people that this is safe and this is effective and that this will help us to round the curve, truly round the curve, in getting us behind, putting the pandemic behind us and beginning to open up society safely, it's going to take leadership at all levels of society. So with that, we'll be able to slowly see our economy come back into bloom.
So, Dr. Seidner, in our remaining time, so we just heard Lenny Marcus lay out really a leadership prescription for how we as a community encourage people to and really have big uptake on the vaccine to get us around this corner. In the meantime, how are you feeling about our ability to manage the surge that we have at hand? I guess I wonder, are we reaching a point where we have a tiger by the tail, or are we still at a point where we can take steps as a human community here in the Commonwealth to curb what's going on right now?
You know, I think it's going to take a combination of these approaches. We have put our faith in the public to wear masks, to physically distance, to do everything in their power to help reduce cases amongst them, their communities, their families, and really to keep in mind that every time we take actions that aren't in line with these recommendations, we're putting people at risk. And we can now see that because our hospitals are full and deaths of COVID-19 are back up. But I think you'll find that most people in the public health community also feel that given the numbers we're seeing in hospitals, given the flu season on its way, given the fact that we're all going to be indoors for the next few months, and given the fact that these vaccines, however promising, are not going to be available to the general public for at least 3 to 6 months, that further restrictions are likely going to be needed. And I think we should be prepared for those now. I think they shouldn't be done unless they're necessary because of the secondary economic detriment they cause. But we need to
I'm sorry, Dr. Seidner. I have to stop you there. That's Dr. Mark Seidner of Mass General and Lenny Marcus of the Kennedy School of Government. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
An overwhelming majority of Massachusetts residents would take a coronavirus vaccine, but those who have been disproportionately affected by the virus are also more likely to want someone else to take it first. That from a new Mass Inc. poll conducted for the Museum of Science and the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers. So we talked with Michael Curry, who's the incoming CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, earlier today about the new numbers, and I began by asking him if he was encouraged that only 7% of respondents said they wouldn't take the vaccine.
I am. I think, we've seen a lot of national polls that have told us that people are not likely to take this vaccine, including half of those polled nationally. What it's telling us is that a majority of people are likely to take it, and we can segment that out. Those that were likely, 36% are likely to take it as soon as it's available. 47% are likely to take it after others take it. And I think that's encouraging, with only 7% saying they would not take it.
So let's talk about that after others part, Michael, because that does seem to be another big finding of the poll. All right. So while 38% of white residents say they'll take the vaccine ASAP, you just went over the numbers with us, 28% of black residents, 22% of Latinx residents say they will, but many will wait until someone else has taken it first. I know you've thought a lot about trust issues in our healthcare system. Do you want to explain what you think you're seeing behind those numbers?
Yeah, I think some of this is unreadiness. We know that there are some folks that are unready, either because of Operation Warp Speed and the perceived haste with which this vaccine is made available. Some would view it as the politics and the division, and maybe that influenced the process. Some have inherent distrust in our system, and that's born out of history. So a combination of all of that is what you see in the polls around those who are waiting on others to take it. And what people say to me is they say, I don't want to be a guinea pig.
So how do you address those fears, Michael? What is that messaging, and what's the communication strategy that the Commonwealth needs to put in place, that community health centers need to put in place? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, one is just the science. I think whatever we can do to bring that information in a way that's digestible, that's understandable about how vaccines work, the benefit of a vaccine, tying that to the disparate impact of this disease on certain communities, giving people the history, not only the history of vaccines, but the history of our healthcare system. And then basically making sure that people understand that this vaccine that is now on the verge of being approved here in the United States gives people an option to survive this pandemic. Once you make and connect all those dots, I'm feeling confident that people will be in line and ready to take the vaccine as soon as they can.
Michael, the poll tells a little bit about who needs to be front and center in delivering those kinds of messages. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, I think there's different groups of folks that we're finding in the poll that people believe, right, that they're trusted messengers. And it's no surprise that the number one trusted messenger, as much as we love Fauci across the country, the number one trusted messenger is your provider, is your primary care provider. You go to your doctor, and whether you have no illness and you're healthy, or you have diabetes or heart disease or cancer or high blood pressure, you're relying on the direction and advice of your provider to guide you through whatever your health condition is. So it's no surprise in the poll that over 80% of those polled believe in and trust in their providers. We need to make sure that providers are on the front line of the messaging. And quite frankly, as we prioritize them in taking the vaccine, providers are also being vaccinated and can say, hey, I took it, and I'm recommending you take it as well. And then there's a cascade of others, institutional folks, community health centers, hospitals are high. So what do we do with all that? There needs to be a cascade of messaging, starting with the primary care providers, messaging down what the data says, what the science says, and the urgency of taking this vaccine.
And I just want to clarify for listeners, when you say Fauci, you mean Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's the head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, who actually in the poll ranks as one of the trusted sources along with some of the other institutions, kind of underscoring your point that medical professionals that people feel they know are important to carrying this message, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, we have our own local versions of that, Monica Burrell, Department of Public Health, and many others that we have at our hospital systems that we trust. And again, they're providers, they're doctors. People want to lean on the people who know.
One of the sources of reticence here has been politicization. We do know that this pandemic, safety measures around the pandemic, responses to the pandemic have been politicized. And one of the things that was interesting in this data was it exposed that those most likely to support wearing, for example, masks are also the ones most likely to go up first on the vaccine. You're talking about white college-educated people, Democrats, people with advanced degrees. On the flip side, 67% of Republicans, for example, said they don't trust the government on healthcare issues. We knew about some of the other divides between government trust and people of color, for example. But these numbers do seem to underscore a politicization of this situation that we also have to address, yes?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's such a difficult time for all of us in this country that we're so politically divided. And now even public health has become a political divide, which it never should be. For any of us who work in this space, we understand the critical nature of this work, that we need to be on the same page. We need to follow the science. And we're not doing that. There are people who are reluctantly wearing their mask, or defiantly is the better word, not wearing their mask because they feel like it's a Democrat thing, or it's an over-exaggeration of this pandemic. The numbers don't lie. You know, we're closely approaching 300,000 people dying of COVID-19 and the skyrocketing infection rates across this country, including here in Massachusetts, that the rates are going up. We can't afford to be politically divided when it's about saving lives. And it's unfortunate, but the poll gives us some places to go, right? Once we know that there's some lack of awareness, some divisions, we can then do the strategies, the messaging that reach those communities that are not responding in the way we need them to.
One of the things that seems to come forward from this poll, Michael, is the need for trusted brokers in the community to bring forward information, bring forward advice and guidance, provide reassurance. We talked a couple of weeks ago on the show with Liz Walker, who's the pastor of Roxbury Presbyterian, who actually got Dr. Fauci to come do a Zoom with her community because she was concerned that her parishioners of color were not going to be comfortable taking this vaccine. As a head of incoming head of a consortium of community health centers, what role do these local neighborhood healthcare providers play? And do you feel they've got the resources they need to play that connecting, brokering role in these next few weeks?
Starting back with, I think the resource question is still yet to be decided, but the poll gives us some places to go, and it lets us know where we need to put our dollars and our people. And the reality is, if it's your local provider, your local public health expert, your local elected official, name the person you may know them from the grocery store or from your local school board meeting, or your children go to the same school. People are already walking up to those people and saying, like Liz Walker, can I take this vaccine? Is it safe? And they're asking me the same thing no matter where I go. The reality is that we need to answer that question, and we need to have the resources to make sure that we're answering it the right way and that we're messaging the right way in the right languages, the right communities, the right cultural competence and how we communicate. We need to be ready to speak to them in the language and with the information they need.
I want to ask you, you said people walk up to you on the street and ask you, is it safe? I should ask you to say on air, what's your answer to that question?
That's a great question. I tell people, once they validated, the FDA gives the green light, we're seeing it approved overseas, I'll be in line to take it as well. This is a matter of life or death. And as I know, I have an aging mother and I have aging family members and I have people with comorbidities. I don't want to risk their lives either. So I'll be in line.
And that was Michael Curry, incoming CEO of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and a member of the NAACP's National Board of Directors. It's the end of the year, and as we reflect on it, one thing that will forever be etched in our memory is how our nation and we as a people confronted our legacies of police brutality and systemic racism. We will remember the faces of Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and so many more. And we'll remember the images of hundreds of thousands of people taking to the streets in protest and sometimes being met with violence and counter-protest. Boston Globe columnist Janae Osterholt is making sure that we also recognize and remember a joy that persisted through it all. Her new series, A Beautiful Resistance, is a celebration of that joy. It profiles Black Bostonians and Massachusetts residents, homeowners, performers, artists, more, as a reminder that Black life is more than suffering, even in the face of injustice. Janae joins us now. Welcome back to the show, Janae.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So this is a rewriting of a narrative, a rejection of a largely white narrative this year, that Black life, especially this year, is suffering. In the weeks during the protests over the summer, what were you seeing from journalism, from the media, that made you say, we need a different narrative?
It wasn't just what I've seen this summer and this year. It's kind of the long-lasting, persistent narrative of what it means to be Black in America, as defined by gatekeepers in the media, which tends to always be through the lens of brutality, always through the lens of inequity and suffering. And while white supremacy is a reality in America, and so is inequity, and Blackness is not a burden, that suffering does not define us. It's not who we are. Sojourner Truth has a pair of quotes, and it's, you know, life is a hard battle anyway. And if we laugh and sing a little as we fight the good fight of freedom, it makes it all go easier. I will not allow the light of my life to be determined by the darkness around me. And I feel like because we've had so little control over our narrative and over our imaging, the narrative has become brutality, it's become crime, it's become violence, it's become suffering. And that strips us of power and agency. When you don't own your story, it strips you of power. And when I got back from Minneapolis from George Floyd's first funeral service, I just wanted a way to wrap my arms around us and hug us, because we can't hug each other right now. And I also wanted a way for people to understand we're more than this, and celebrate us while we're here, while we're alive. You shouldn't have to watch one of us be lynched for 8 minutes to suddenly invest in our humanity.
Janae, you talked about these other frames, these other images, brutality and violence. You chose joy, Black joy and Black life. And you come at that as a Black journalist. And you had a really interesting conversation about this with Boston-based photographer O.J. Slaughter, who is the focus of your third installation about their documentation of this summer's protests. I do recognize that this is about more than just the documentation over the summer, but it was a remarkable moment, and O.J. Slaughter's documentation of community and joy. I'm going to play a little exchange from your interview with them about the agency of Black storytellers.
I am so sick of the story being told with the same image with different intent. I think that my platform allows people to see themselves, through the work that I post. And it rings true to them instead of feeling like, who is this white person talking about what happened in the situation when that's not what happened at all?
Well, and it's not their lived experience.
No.
So I think it creates a different dynamic when you try to tell someone what racism looks like or what it feels like or what oppression feels like when it's not something that you're actually feeling.
Can you talk more about this importance of someone who has lived experience themselves telling a story the way that you do, the way that O.J. Slaughter does?
It's imperative. Media, and not just legacy media, not just newspapers, but also digital media, like media period across the board, on TV, on the radio, in newsrooms, everywhere, like it doesn't reflect America. There are very few Black journalists and journalists of color in these newsrooms telling stories. And when you start to look at the coverage, you very soon realize coverage of Black and brown people is often crime, sports, celebrity, or murder. You know, we don't get the everyday living stories. And when we do, they're not the centerpiece. They're not, you know, above the fold. They're not with beautiful big pictures like the ones that white people get the luxury and privilege of having. Black journalists have always done this work. Black newspapers have always done this work. But when you are a Black journalist at a white paper, at a paper that's dominated by all white editors, trying to explain the importance of telling stories like these for years and getting them to get the big A1 coverage, the big centerpiece coverage, has been hard for journalists all over the country, because you soon realize that you kind of have to validate and define things that no one else has to validate or define, where people don't understand how something works. And that chips away at your spirit a little bit. It's the friends, you know, I often use the dynamic, the story of Friends and Living Single. Everyone knows what Friends is. If I write a story and I reference Ross and Rachel, no editor is going to say to me, explain, you know, that Friends was this hit TV show that stole from Living Single. If I write about Living Single, an editor will ask me, well, you know what, you might want to put a sentence in there and explain what Living Single is. And that's a very hard thing to grasp, like to constantly be put in a place of validating your lived experience, which is why we need more Black editors. We need more Black journalists in the room, more Spanish speaking journalists in the room, and in Boston, more French Creole speaking journalists in the room.
Your videos and the articles really bring us to leaders, community organizers, artists who are having a lived experience in Greater Boston. I want to play a little more sound here. This is Mercy Bell, who is the subject of your first installation and a Black homeowner on Martha's Vineyard. Here is a clip from a video interview you did with Mercy Bell.
Until this year, I had a really hard time being here and enjoying myself, because there was like this, how dare we as a family have this much space to be in and this much beauty to look at? And it was really the first time I was here and just present and like feeling joy to be here was this summer.
This is a homeowner, someone who should feel that way all the time in the place they own, in the place they live. How powerful was it for the people you interviewed, for the people you spoke with, to have this opportunity to tell a different story and tell about themselves, you know, Martha's Vineyard in this case?
You know, I don't want to speak for them on how it feels for them, but I will say that readers who have not got to see themselves with this type of branding and this type of real estate in the paper and online have been very fulfilled. I think getting a platform like this and being able to share your story gives you agency. It gives you access, and it lets people know that, you know, even if you do, like, I know that Mercy and OJ know they matter, but it does mean something to have representation and to also be able to connect to the community at large. And media just can't keep shutting us out. It just can't. It's not a sustainable model. You don't cover these communities, you serve these communities. And for too long, we forgot that we're supposed to be serving the community and telling the truth. And if you only tell the story of pain, you're not telling the whole truth.
Yeah, there's more than a century of Black homeownership on Martha's Vineyard. I wonder, were there readers who were completely unaware of that when you...
There were. So many. And it's very sad, but it's the reason why, you know, despite a century of home ownership there, despite some of the, you know, the first freed slaves being able to buy land there, people don't know these stories because the American way is not to tell stories of Black triumph and Black victory. Those aren't stories we tell. We erase those stories because when you erase those stories, you disempower a people. And that's what journalism has to be, start becoming accountable for and start performing correctives over. Like, we have been complicit, our industry has been complicit in disempowering of people by not telling the whole story.
You know, in your conversation with O.J. Slaughter, you talk about the importance of who the storyteller is. We touched on that, but also about how, as a Black journalist, you not only document Black life, but live it every day yourself. You can step away from your job, but not who you are. You've titled this series Beautiful Resistance. How is your life Beautiful Resistance?
You know, I think my life is a beautiful resistance because, as Toni Morrison would say, we do language. You know, I get to do words. I do story. I witness. I mark time and space. You know, every story I write, every column I write is an opportunity, a privilege to use my space to amplify the importance of equity and social justice in protecting culture and community. You know, we've been so tricked into thinking that there's a such thing as voicelessness when there is not. There's systems that create the illusion of voicelessness. There's systems that silence and suppress. But that's not who we are. And, you know, my resistance is the words, it's the language, it's the writing, it's moments like this, the, you know, the beautiful resistance, being able to go into a room and say, this is the story that we need to tell because these people matter, I matter too.
That is Boston Globe columnist Janae Osterholt. Thank you so much for taking the time for us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We want to revisit another conversation in our series, Living Through Corona. These cold winter days strangely harken back to the spring, as coronavirus infections spread rapidly and hospitals become taxed. Last night, we heard from Robert Lewis Jr. He's founder and president of The Base, a nonprofit based in Roxbury that uses baseball and softball to provide academic and career resources to local student athletes. Lewis survived COVID-19 but was hospitalized with the disease. When he spoke with us in September, he emphasized the strength he drew from his family and friends, like the week he was finally able to return home.
It was amazing when my daughter picked me up at Spalding and to see her. And then to pull up at my house and my son, you know, his partner, their daughter, you know, standing out front of my house with a sign and like, we love you, Dad, we love you. And, you know, your wife, because my kids couldn't go inside, right? And they were all in masks. And again, that was so surreal. And for 7 days, we were home and I had to wear a mask at home with my wife. And then it was on the 8th day when my daughter and my son were able to come in and see me. And to be there with my family meant the world to me.
Robert Lewis Jr. knew how lucky he was to be reunited with his family. Not everyone can see their families now, however, especially if the risk to loved ones is high. And that's especially true for older adults, says Elizabeth Davis, a home care worker in Springfield, Greenfield, and Amherst.
It's been tough because the family can't come in to see them. They have to stay at a distance now, speak to my clients through the door. That's the difficult part because my clients, when they are dementia, they don't understand how come their family can't come inside the house.
Elizabeth's been a home care worker for 35 years and serves particularly vulnerable clients, older adults in their 90s. When we spoke with her in October, she told us the pandemic has changed the way she works with them.
A lot of them are surprised when they come in, they see me, and I'm all masked up and gloved up. And sometimes they say, well, you don't have to have your mask on. But I do. I don't know from my travels back and forth if I'm carrying the COVID or if they have it. So I'm protecting them and protecting myself.
Does it scare them, especially those clients who have dementia, to see you look so different in your personal protective equipment?
Yes, it's very difficult for them because most of them are deaf, and over the years, they're able to read lips. So we have to stand back, pull the mask down, and speak to them where they can read our lips. We just can't be comfortable in taking care of them. We have to make sure that we use all the precautions, constantly washing our hands each time we touch them or glove up. And we're still looking for PPE.
How are you getting the PPE that you need?
Well, in the beginning, I had a coworker. Her family member were making the cotton mask, and I started out wearing the cotton mask. And then surgical masks were coming to me, but maybe four masks in a pack from my agency, which is still not enough. And I began to wash those out and use them two or three times. But I'm in a need for PPE, plenty of it, because the way that this COVID-19 is going, we're going to have it for a couple of years.
You are almost 70, which means you're high risk yourself. You know, I find myself wondering, what's it like for you each day as you sort of approach the front door of a client's home, aware of both their vulnerabilities and yours?
I know that they don't have COVID, but we have different aides that go in and out with my client. So when I come in there, I be on guard at all times because you never know.
What's at stake for you if you get sick, Elizabeth?
Well, because I'm high risk, it would be very frightening for me because I think about my family members. If I really got sick and they couldn't come and see me, you know, it would be horrible, terrible.
Have you been able to see your loved ones and your family members?
I've talked to them over the phone, but to get together like we normally would do for our family gatherings, our family reunions, we couldn't do that.
That's got to be hard.
It is very hard. It's very, very hard because I'm so used to seeing my family in person.
How are you keeping yourself whole, mentally whole, emotionally whole? You know, where are you getting the psychological hugs from when you can't be with your own family?
What I have been doing is listening to comedy, and comedy has put me in a place where I'm not stressed out. I can laugh, and they always say laughter is a good medicine. I'm not always into myself. My compassion is not going inward, but it's outward. So I empty myself of myself, and I take care of my client.
What's your favorite source of comedy?
Oh, you probably Trevor Noah. You know him?
Absolutely.
He is hilarious.
Of the Daily Show.
The Daily Distant Daily Show now. He can take a sad moment and make it to a happy moment. Not where it pulls you down, but it gives you uplift. That's why I love listening to him.
You talked about emptying yourself to do this work. Does the work empty you, or do you feel the need to empty yourself of yourself in order to do your work?
I feel the need to empty myself so I can do the work, because if I didn't do that, then I wouldn't take care of my clients.
Do you see yourself as a frontline worker?
Yes, I do. But to my community and to my representative, I'm invisible, and we need to be recognized. I need to be recognized as a frontline worker.
What makes you feel invisible?
I'm constantly hearing on TV, radio, they talk about frontline workers as those who work in the hospital, first responder, police officers, but never hear about home care workers. I feel at a low point, like no one cares about me and my work.
What could our communities do to better recognize and support the work that you're doing as a home care worker?
I would like to see our community back us up, rallying for us, that we need to be recognized, but not only to be recognized, we need livable wages. We at like the lowest wage rate right now, and I don't think that's equal. I don't think it's fair. Look like our representatives are marginalized our work, and it's important. Some of us is just barely making it on the wages that they paying us through the home care agencies. I have to work a lot of hours to make ends meet.
You were recently featured, Elizabeth, on a billboard. It's part of a campaign for your union, SEIU 1199. The billboard was to highlight the role of home care workers in fighting COVID and racism, and it read, quote, "Home care workers are fighting to be seen and heard because our lives matter," end quote. What does it mean for you to be seen and heard right now, both as a home care worker and as a Black woman?
I would love to see that our representatives take note in our work and to uplift us and to provide us with equal pay, equality. We are not recognized. We're not seen, and we're not being heard.
I know Governor Baker proclaimed September 4th, this year, 2020, as Home Care Day, in recognition of the work that home care workers do. Is that a step in the right direction? Is that the kind of recognition you want?
Yes, it's a step, but we are not quite there yet. They need to talk policy about us and about our work.
Elizabeth, has the pandemic changed you in any fundamental way? And if so, what is that?
Sometimes I think that one end is a blessing for me because I can still continue to care for my clients. That's what it's done for me. And I'm driven by this pandemic to do better and to know better. And I better serve my client right now because I'm really on my P's and Q's with them.
That's Elizabeth Davis, a home caregiver who works in Springfield, Amherst, and Greenfield. Elizabeth, really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you so much. And you be safe. Noah Trevor says, be positive and test negative.
I will work on both. And really, please take care of yourself. Take good care.
Yes, I will. Thank you so much.
That conversation from October is part of our ongoing series, Living with Corona. Do you have a personal story about this pandemic? How has the virus changed your life this past year? Whether you're a working mom or out of work, a virtual student, or a loved one who's grieving, tell us your story. Or tell us about someone else you think we should feature. You can email us at radioboston@gmail.com. That's radioboston@gmail.com. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.